Ace Lanantrum with Pharmacy Times, and welcome back to a special limited series from the Pharmacy Focus podcast, delving into the new frontier of anti-obesity medications and treatments. In the last two episodes, we learned from two experts on new anti-obesity medications, as well as new guidelines on pediatric obesity interventions. This week, we're continuing the discussion with Claudia Fox, an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. Fox reviews potential pharmacotherapy and surgical interventions for children with obesity and discusses potential concerns that parents could have about the long-term impacts. What kind of medications are offered for children who are struggling with obesity, and how early do children start using these medications?
Well, there's now, more than ever before, we have many more options available to treat obesity in the pediatric population. So there are several that are now FDA approved, and there are also still a couple that are not FDA approved that are used in particularly younger kids. So the FDA approved medications are the semaglutide, Wegovy for kids 12 and older, Saxenda, liraglutide, also for kids 12 and older, and then Qsymia, combination phentermine topiramate, also for kids 12 and older. There are a couple older medicines, too, that are also FDA approved for this age range 12 and older. So that includes Orlistat, also known as Ally. And then phentermine is approved for individuals older than 16, but for discrete periods of time. According to the FDA label, it's advised to treat only for 12 weeks at a time. So practically speaking, most of us in the pediatric obesity world use it chronically, just like you would in it for adults with obesity. Because remember, this phentermine was FDA approved back in the 1950s when we didn't really recognize obesity as a chronic disease. And so understanding that now, we use it chronically. So that's kind of the list of those that are FDA approved. Many pediatric obesity medicine specialists, particularly those working in specialty clinics, also use medications in an off-label manner for those kids who are under 12, including topiramate, lisdexamfetamine or Vyvanse, metformin. Those are the main ones.
Some of these injectable medications have serious adverse effects. How could this affect the children's physical health?
So, you know, we as pediatric obesity medicine providers need to weigh the risks and benefits of every intervention. The risks of living with severe obesity as a child are enormous. The children with severe obesity have shortened life expectancy. They are much more likely to have severe comorbidities, type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea, hypertension, fatty liver disease, and also have serious mental illness, depression, anxiety, eating disorders. And we know that obesity in children and adolescents is a progressive disease. So you have to keep that in mind when we're thinking about any treatment that we're, you know, that we're considering. And while for sure true, the injectable medications, this class of medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonist, is associated with some side effects, on the whole, those side effects are relatively minimal. So for sure, with appropriate dose titration, with adjustments to eating behaviors and dietary patterns, you can minimize those GI side effects. What is still a big question mark is, what is the long-term effect of these medications on children and adolescents? What is the implication of using these medications for years and years and years, perhaps decades, in a child that is still undergoing development, right? Still might be in the peripubertal phase, still brain is for sure still maturing. We don't know, frankly, what will be the long-term outcomes in, say after 40 years of exposure to said medications. But it's also likely that an individual is probably not going to be on the same medication for 40 years, or even 20 years for that matter. And we have to balance that with the definite knowledge of, wow, this, my patient in front of me, my 12-year-old kid who already has fatty liver disease with cirrhosis, they might not even make it to 20 years, later, because of their obesity. So it really is for each individual patient weighing the relative risks of not treating the obesity, versus benefits of treating the obesity, as well as the risk and benefits of the particular medications. So according to the American Academy of Pediatrics Clinical Practice Guidelines, we as pediatric healthcare providers should be offering these medications to any kid who is 12 and older who has obesity. Doesn't really define specifically what degree of obesity. So just obesity, which by definition is a BMI greater than the 95th percentile. So yes, obesity comes in different classifications, class one, two, three, if you will. The guidelines don't specify, oh, you have to wait until a kid achieves a certain degree of obesity. And in part, I agree 100% with those recommendations. We know that 12-year-olds with class one obesity, so just non-severe obesity, if you will, are very likely to go on to develop obesity as an adult. It's not like they're going to magically grow out of it, particularly once they've become an adolescent. So as a medical provider, yeah, of course, I'm much more likely to start medications right away in a teenager who has severe obesity. If it's a teenager who has class one obesity, I'm probably going to start with lifestyle therapy first and see if we can make some improvements with that alone. But if that's not working, then absolutely it is appropriate to add on medication, to help make the lifestyle therapy be more effective, to help a patient adhere to the dietary changes that are needed to achieve a healthier size.
How could these adverse effects affect the perception of anti-obesity medications for children and even for their parents?
To date, most of the families that I've been discussing these injectable, are you talking about injectable medications in particular, or I guess with any anti-obesity medication, families are just so relieved to have an option, to have a real effective treatment option. So, I think they're cautious about potential side effects, but with good anticipatory guidance about what to expect, how to minimize those side effects. Families, kids are just so eager to start the medications as soon as possible. They've been, for the most part, struggling for years and years and years, trying to eat better, trying to move more, and have simply not been able to achieve a healthy weight because there have yet to be an intervention that really addresses the underlying core of what obesity is. That is a disorder of the energy regulatory system. And so with medications which target that energy regulatory system specifically, they're now able to get some real results.
Do you believe that anti-obesity medications in general for children will affect their mental health when it comes to how they view being overweight? Could this potentially cause an increase in childhood disordered eating?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the response is probably fairly variable. What is notable, though, in the STEP Teens trial, which is the randomized controlled clinical trial of semaglutide or Wegovy, that garnered the data to give to the FDA to get approval. So this is a, sort of the landmark trial of semaglutide in teenagers. That study showed substantial, clinically significant improvements in quality of life in those kids who were taking the medication compared to those kids who did not get the medication. So that's really important to know. This is for the first time an anti-obesity medication study in teenagers showed improvement in quality of life. And it's probably because the weight loss effect with the medication was way in excess of what we had seen to date with other anti-obesity medications. So I hear what you're saying about how some kids might perceive that, oh, there must be something wrong with me. I need a medication to get to a healthier size. But with good education of the patient, if I think you can minimize some of those beliefs. If the provider takes the time to inform the patient, the kid, and their family that obesity is not your fault, that it is a disorder of, again, the energy regulation system that's often inherited from family members, they begin to see obesity for what it is, as a metabolic problem, really, not a neurometabolic problem, not just a problem of being lazy or, you know, whatever stereotype you have, may have. Well, there's no evidence to indicate that these medications would increase eating disorders. In fact, what we know is that youth who get appropriate professional treatment for their obesity within the context of a weight management clinic or whatever medically supervised, those kids tend to have less eating disorder symptoms than kids who are trying to DIY weight loss, right? So it is important for kids who are struggling to seek medical care such that they can achieve a healthier weight using healthy tactics, if you will, as opposed to restriction, starvation, meal skipping, you name it. And also to that point is that many kids who present to our weight management clinics already have some degree of disordered eating at baseline. That's how they've been trying to lose weight to date without having that direction of, you know, the professional direction of a dietitian or a physician.
Have you listened to other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus? We have podcasts for all interests, from students to psychedelics. In the latest episode of Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, we had a special crossover episode with Pharmacy Focus Psychedelic Pharmacy, discussing psychedelic medicines in oncology care. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts. What kinds of surgical intervention will be taken for children, and at what age would this begin?
So surgical intervention, so metabolic and bariatric surgery is an intervention that is advised by the American Academy of Pediatrics for certain children and adolescents. The eligibility criteria are based primarily on BMI and the presence of weight-related comorbidities. So the BMI cut points, if you will, include a BMI greater than 1.2 times the 95th percentile, up to 1.4 times the 95th percentile, but only if there is a weight-related comorbidity also present, or greater than 1.4 times the 95th percentile without regard to the presence of weight-related comorbidities. If you wanted, there is an AAP statement on metabolic and bariatric surgery that will detail those eligibility criteria. I think the author is Armstrong. Yes, published in 2019 in Pediatrics. So that would be a good, you know, reference for you if you wanted to learn a little bit more about it. So there isn't a necessarily an age limit per se. It's really made the decision to pursue surgery is really made on an individual basis. It's just really based on those on BMI and weight-related comorbidities.
Since children are still growing and developing, will a surgical intervention impact their health as they get older?
No, that is another really good question. So in part why there is no sort of lower age limit is that what we do know is that having obesity negatively impacts children's growth and pubertal development. So by normalizing their weight status, they have an opportunity to achieve normal growth and pubertal development. Also, there are ample studies that have shown that surgery in even very, very, very young, like school age children, does not negatively impact their growth or development. These are not randomized controlled trials because that's hard to do ethically, but large retrospective studies in the younger kids. There are some few large prospective studies, but those prospective studies were only of adolescents. The retrospective studies include the younger school age, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old. So that's based on that literature. The AAP did not put a lower age limit on recommendations for bariatric surgery.
What are some benefits and complications that parents should be aware of for surgery for their child?
Well, there are major benefits in that it can substantially improve virtually all weight-related comorbidities. So really can improve and almost in many cases lead to resolution of type 2 diabetes. It can substantially improve sleep apnea, fatty liver disease, dyslipidemia. So it is very, very good for improving metabolic health. With regard to mental health, there is some improvement in depression symptomatology, but that seems to be a bit short-lived in that over time, depression symptoms tend to return. If you've had them pre-surgery, you're likely still to have them after surgery. In terms of complications, there are short-term complications and longer-term complications, and they kind of depend on the type of surgery that is performed. Today, the most common is the sleeve gastrectomy in adolescents. Probably second most common is the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. Short-term complications may be related to the procedures themselves. Longer-term complications include things like gastroesophageal reflux disease, especially for the sleeve gastrectomy. There's risk for nutrient deficiencies for sure. Kind of depends, the profile really depends on the type of surgery. But nutrient deficiencies are probably the most common one.
There are many different interventions for children starting as early as age 2. Will any of this have a long-term impact on their mental health or even physical health as they get older?
Yeah, I think it's more of a misperception of really what we are talking about. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations to start intervention at age 2 is really, the guidance is really to make sure that the child is eating a healthy type of food and a healthy amount of food. Nothing more than that. It's not restriction per se. It is making sure that the child is eating an age appropriate amount of food. So if the kid is 2 and they're eating a 5-year-old amount of food, then sure, you could consider it restriction if you're trying to get it down to age 2. I don't want people to think that this is some egregious that kids are being put on a diet per se, that toddlers are being put on a diet per se. No, they are putting on a healthy eating plan, and with regular physical activity, something that should be true for all children, regardless of age or size. The difference is that there is more attention being made to the healthy eating and activity, more frequent touch points, more support for the family to do this type of intervention, if you want to call it that. Any person who carries extra weight does so because their body is not, doesn't have the proper energy regulatory system to keep it in check. And the reason why it's not working correctly varies from person to person, the main determinant being a patient's genetics. But there are a whole host of other factors that can interfere with that, including stress, whether it is stress from racism, stress from food insecurity, stress from depression. It could be medications interfering with the energy regulatory system. It could be other biological issues, genetic problems. Other weight-related comorbidities can feed into it. Having sleep apnea, poor sleep can feed into progressive weight gain. So bottom line is that person with obesity, I've heard this quote somewhere before, it's not just a thin person who ate too much. That's not what obesity is. It's really a person who's not able to appropriately regulate, their energy stores. And that's a process that happens subconsciously. It's not under our volitional control. And so if we can recognize that, then that reduces blame and shame and stigma around treating obesity. And then patients may be more open to receiving treatment, but they need to hear this from their medical providers.
Thank you for listening to this limited series from Pharmacy Focus. If you're interested in learning more, check out pharmacytimes.com and stay tuned for all of our other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus.